Bye-bye. Okay, well, that brings us to the next item on our agenda, which is our postponed item from last week. Wayne Costi will give us a brief presentation on Lloyd England, and the PDF accompanying his presentation can be linked, downloaded. It's on your draft agenda. There's a little link there under the draft agenda for this PDF, so you can follow along with the show. Wayne, go ahead.
Yes, Ken, can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
oh,
great.
Oh, hang on. So, I'm going to put us into lecture mode, Wayne, so there won't be any background
okay.
noise. So one moment. Yeah.
Okay, great. So for those of you that don't have the agenda, you can get a copy of this presentation at hopeoutloud.org/Pentagon. Hopeoutloud.org/Pentagon. It's the top one, top item at the moment. So you can follow along there. There's a number of slides I want to go through. I got about 15 minutes to run through them. The reason I'm doing this is because it's the Lloyd England taxicab story has circulated around quite a bit. There seems to be a lot of misinformation, and in my review of the accident, the taxicab issue, I've seen very little discussion of the evidence. And so I wanted to just kind of go through what I have been able to find and share that with you. So if you go to slide two, we're going to have we've got a table of context. We're going to give an overview of the accident scene. We're going to talk about the probable mechanics of the destruction of lampposts. We're going to document the parts of lamppost number two, then lamppost number one, and come up with some observations. And there's an appendix with some additional material. Again, slide three, the purpose is that the review of the taxicab incident is that when treated as an accident scene using the physics of motion, the location of the taxi and debris supports Lloyd's survivor fund statement. The location of most debris from light poles number one and two is documented in the photographic record. The location of the debris from light poles one and two is consistent with the high-speed impact of a flying thing called an airplane, I guess, at a point below the attachment point of the lamp support arms. That's what that's what I've observed, and I'll share that with you. So going to slide four, the text of Lloyd's Survivor Fund statement, which many of you are familiar with, is, Lloyd, 69, began the morning of September 11th, 2001, like most days, driving his taxicab. As he approached the Navy Annex, he saw a plane flying dangerously low overhead. Simultaneously, the plane struck a light pole, and the pole came crashing down onto the front of Lloyd's taxicab, destroying the windshield in front of his eyes. Glass was everywhere as he tried to stop the car. Another car stopped, and the driver helped move the heavy pole off Lloyd's car. As they were moving the pole, they heard a big boom and turned to see an explosion. The light pole fell on Lloyd, and he struggled to get up underneath, wondering what had happened. The reason I've highlighted the big boom is some of the people who described the Lloyd incident claim that that explosion is actually the plane hitting the building a second and a half later, and they say it couldn't happen because you can't have anyone get out of the car try to pull out a pole in the second and a half it takes. So. But what they forget is, and we'll touch on that in a little bit here, is that there was another large explosion 4 to 6 minutes later. So if you go to slide five, the windshield and the rear seat are damaged by the light pole. Many people have seen the slide on page five, which is the windshield damage. Slides six and seven are small holes in the rear seat of the fabric. Significant holes, but not anything really huge. So going into slide eight, we have a depiction of Lloyd's taxicab with a pole. The top is what they call the doodle by Lloyd England himself, showing that the pole is sticking out over the hood a little bit. And interestingly enough, it's got a little knob on the top, and that looks we'll talk about that a little bit later. Depiction by another person, I don't know who it was, has the mast pole sticking out of his light out of the taxicab with a bend in it, and it looks like Pinocchio's nose, but It's not at all like any of the pictures of the evidence. So going into slide 9, we have the Darrell Donnelly explosion captured 4 to 6 minutes after impact. Darrell reports that this did sound like an explosion. So 4 to 6 minutes for someone to stop, try to pull a pole out of the windshield is consistent with the Darrell Donnelly recorded explosion. So slide 11 gets into the nomenclature of the lamp pole parts. This is taken from a Jason Ingersoll photo on 9/11. You can see that there's the mast, which is the upright. We've got a lower arm and an upper arm. The lower arm is mostly straight for most of the length, and you can see that there is, in fact, at the very tip, there is a connector to the upper arm, and that is remarkably like the dimple that we saw on Lloyd's doodle. Going on to slide 12. If you want to take a look at stopping and reaction times, you see at 40 miles an hour, the stopping distance with reaction time is about 164 feet from standard tables, including reaction times. So if we take a look at I've got three slides here. They're all on the same scale. These are the hypothesized locations of the impacts on light lamp post number 1, lamp post number 2 on the left-hand side. Going on to slide 14, what we have are a couple of the pieces of the poles shown in red. The blue squares are the taxi cab where it was stopped at the bottom. And going up 160 feet, the nominal stopping distance is where the light pole the taxi cab would have been if he were to be trying to stop at standard stopping speeds and distances for about 40 miles an hour. And that would mean that it would be just to the a little bit upstream, shall we say, of where the light post lamp post could have been. So what we're hypothesizing here is that the locations were right for something to have been hit the lamppost number 2, the dot on the left and the upper left side, and parts of it to have hit his car, and then for him to have stopped in 160 feet. Slide 15, again, same scale. We're going to zoom in on these a little bit to show the locations. We've got the mast and the upper arm and lamp 2. We'll just kind of go through these on the next slides that are zoomed in a little bit more. Slide 16 is just a zoomed in portion. I guess I've already said everything that needs to be done. We've got 80 feet of reaction time and 80 feet of braking time at 40 miles an hour to get from from where he stopped. We know that for sure, and where he probably started. With a pole in his windshield, flying glass, and all that other stuff. Slide 17 documents the locations, and we're going to see pictures of these. Of all the things I've laid out here. We've got mast 2. We've got the pole. We've got the upper arm and lamp 2, and then the lowest part. We have the upper and lower arm and lamp 1 below. We've got the large curved piece. And then there's parts of mast 1 in the travel lane, the left-hand travel lane or near it. Slide 19 is going to talk about the problem mechanics of the destruction of the light poles. Again, I've seen very little discussion of anything related to the physics, so just a lot of going back and forth about I believe them, I don't believe them. But if you actually look at the evidence as I've done here and go through it, it looks pretty realistic that we have the poles being severed at impact at mid-mast height. The mast is very quickly severed. It's a light gauge aluminum. I wouldn't want to drive my car into it, but it can be severed. The support arms and lamps and lamps. Support arms and lamps have little horizontal acceleration due to their inertia, and they fall near their original location once it's been severed. And the middle 5 feet of mass number one suggests the impact by a kind of a large mass, probably the leading wing spar, and is actually severed and goes much further. Slide 20 is shows the sequence of an impact. There's an initial impact where it's severed at about, showing here, about 22 feet off the ground. The top parts kind of rotate around, and this is for mass number one, because you can see that there's about a 5 foot section that is continuing to go and travel downward, and will end up, we'll see that in the near the left travel lane. Slide 22, we're going to start about talking about lamppost number two. The mass appears to be bent at a 90 degrees, not severed. The mass is found laying to the left of the flight path, suggesting to me that the mass was hit by a much weaker part of the wing. The lamp and the upper support arm appear to be on the fog line, shoulder of Route 27, landed near the base of lamppost number two, approximately under their original location. It's not, you can't place it exactly with a photo, but it's pretty close. And the lower support arm, the one thing that isn't well documented or clearly documented is the lower support arm for mass number two. Slide 23 shows the mast of lamppost number two is visible from a distance. Slide 24, we're going to zoom in on it. You can see it's bent, laying down on the side. Slide 25 is a photo by Courtney Platt, and you can see the fog line, and this image has a picture of that Courtney took. It shows the upper arm of the lamp post and the lamp mat, the lamp head itself, and with the Pentagon burning in the distance. And the image on the right shows about where this is located. And it's right at the base of, just a little bit away from the base of where the lamppost mast number two would have been connected to the base, to the concrete footing. So now we're going to go look at lamppost number one. Here the mast was severed into three parts. Mast one is the large segment, the lower 25 feet or so, seen in the right travel lane. Mast two, part two, is a middle 5 foot segment seen near the left travel lane. Mast part number three is a top, about a 1 foot segment. It's still connected to the upper support arms and initially seen on the travel line, in the travel lane of the fog line, on the travel lane side of the fog line. It's going to be moved in some of the later photos. Upper and lower support arms are still together in these images here. So, slide 28 is the mast parts one and two for lamppost number one, and you can see mast part number two is near the travel lane. There were cars traveling in that lane immediately after the impact. It was clear, relatively clear. When you take a look at the other images here, we see the mast part one on the right-hand side extending in front of the car, and then there's a lamp or something else that is pointed out. I'm not quite sure what that is. It doesn't seem to be either the lamp itself or anything else. I'm not sure what it is. But moving on to slide 29, this is a Jason Ingersoll photo. It's taken with a telephoto lens, so things are a little this perspective is a bit challenged here, but you can see the curve of the lamppost as it was bent, and you can see in the background. We'll zoom in on those. The upper and lower lamp support arms, and let's kind of zoom in to slide 30. You can now clearly see the upper part of the mast is shown there, mast part three, and still connected to the one of the lamp support arms. The lamp head is, I believe, to the left of that under the labeling there. for Mass 3. Slide 31, it's just a zoom in of that zoom in, and you can see the things more clearly. You can actually see the wires hanging out of the coming out of the lamppost. I don't know which arm it would have come out of, probably the upper one, but you can see it, a lot of some detail. Wish there was more, but that's what we have. Slide 32 is just it's a different photo. This one now has a mystery piece in it. We don't know what it is. We don't think it's either of the two lamp, the upper or lower lamp arms, because the part three of mast one has been moved to the curved side of the fog line. The mystery piece could be either the lower arm of lamp light post number two, the one that was not photographed in the debris that we saw a few slides earlier. And of course, you can see mast part two of mast one near the left travel lane again. What we have for observations is on slide 34, most of the parts of the lamp posts 1 and 2 are accounted for in photos. Both the lamp post masts are seen. The mast 1 is in three parts. Mast 2 is in one piece that's bent at 90 degrees. Both upper support arms are accounted for. Both one lower support arm for lamp post 1 is seen. The lower support arm for lamp post 2 is missing and probably is what impaled Lloyd's taxicab. And so that's what I have. There's appendices that give a full text of Lloyd's survivor sense story, one of the witnesses that saw the light poles being hit. So I guess I can open it for questions now.
Okay, let's go into Q&A mode here. 1 second. So if you want to ask a question or make a comment, star 6, and it'll put you into the queue. Star 6 if you want to ask a question or make a comment. And Sander, you're first.
Hey, Wayne, appreciate this as always. I have a question on slide 29. Slide 29, I'm looking at a light pole face with four anchoring bolts. This is where the light pole is affixed to its concrete footing. And the pole has this really substantial curve in it. And then there's torn metal at the end of that. In your earlier slide, you'd speculated that a wing or some other object had severed the pole midway and that it had broken into three discrete pieces. And I'm wondering how you explain this curvature in this lower portion of the lamp. That's one question. And then the second is on slide 31, you're calling what looks to be two wires, a lower arm of lamppost and an upper arm of lamppost, but they really look like just electrical wires. So I was wondering if you could maybe explain that slide a little bit more. Thanks.
Well, first of all, the reason I pointed out that the perspectives are a problem with the Jason Ingersoll photo is it appears to have been taken with a telephoto lens. And any little bit of curve kind of shows up, and it looks amplified at that low angle. If you look at some of the other photos, and I'm trying to come up with some that I've included here, you'll see that it's not nearly as dramatic when seen from a different angle. So, for example, on slide 28, it looks a lot less bent than it does in that Jason Ingersoll photo. I pondered that, and my answer to that is that it is just a function of the telephoto lens kind of amplifying, kind of compressing the curve. So I'm not sure that I recall specifically what you wanted to know about the about the others. So could you repeat the question?
Yeah, slide 30. It says mask part 3. And, okay, I maybe see why you're calling that part 3. Slide 31 has me a bit confused. I see top of mask and then lower arm of lamppost. And, well, I just can't agree that what we're looking at are lower arms of the lamppost based on the diameter of it, the clear, like, seething material around an electrical wire. And these look like the wires that run within the lamp. I don't see how those – are you thinking that those are metal armatures?
Yeah, it's my supposition, I guess you have to say, since I don't have these things in hand. But
sure.
It's my supposition that these are, in fact, the lamp support arms, and that what you're actually looking at is the top of the mast attached to something. These are approximately the right length to be the support arms. They're badly mangled or straightened out or whatever you want to call it. They do seem to be attached. You know, again, the photographic record is not complete, of course, but I think this is the best description of what we're observing here. Okay? Anything else? Oh, you had another question, I think, another part.
No, that's it for now.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Okay, let's see. Anybody else have a question on this queue there?
Yes. Yeah, I'm down for a question, Ken. Do you have me or?
No, because you're a host, so you just have to ask the question.
Okay, is it my turn or is it someone else?
Yes, it's your turn. There's somebody else on the queue that I can see.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Well, first of all, I have to throw out the comment that I think, Wayne, that you're going to incredible lengths to try to make this part of the 9/11 story, which is one of the most unbelievable parts of certainly the Pentagon story. You seem to be twisting yourself into knots to try to make it seem possible that this could have happened. And I want to – there's a few details that I have to bring up from your presentation. First of all, you refer to the Survivors Fund account, and – right in the account, it doesn't match the physical evidence. There's a quote in there where he says that the plane struck a light pole and the pole came crashing down onto the front of Lloyd's taxi cab. Well, you know, we know it didn't come crashing down onto the car because there's not even a scratch on the hood. So I want to make that point. Also, you have the diagram from one person's depiction of the pole sticking out of the front of the car. Well, that person wasn't a witness. So that's just a diagram of what might have happened. That's not – nobody saw that. In fact, nobody saw the pole hit the cab at all, and no one saw Lloyd and his silent stranger friend who stopped and supposedly helped him pull the pole out of the car. No one saw this. I also want to mention that on slide 29, you've got the one with the perspective or the telephoto perspective. If you look at other photos of that, you're quite right. It is an exaggerated curvature that you see in the pole. But in fact, the pole is curved in other photos as well. It's just more of a gradual curve. So I think that's still unexplained. And also there's a scratch that goes across the road on slide 29. And I pointed that out in our debate back last year. That appears to match up with the end of the pole. It appears that the pole has been dragged across the road and placed where it is. Perhaps you might want to comment on that. But the most important one I wanted to, and I know I'm throwing a lot of stuff at you here, but the last one I guess I'll first of all, there's the back seat hole. You referred to it as significant but not huge. I don't know how you can call that significant. I don't even know if – I think if you put your fist through that hole, it would make it bigger than it is now. So how does that constitute a significant hole? I don't understand. But in terms of the physics, I forget which slide it is. You have the right wing of the plane, which is swept back from perpendicular to the fuselage. You have that making contact with the pole, and yet somehow the pole goes not to the right where you would think it would go, but it goes forward somehow above or be below or somehow the fuselage to go up the road, straight up the road, and into Lloyd's cab. I don't see how the physics of that work out at all. So I'll leave it there, and you can comment on any of that stuff you want.
I'll go through what I can. You know, first of all, you mentioned the Survivors Fund. It was not a legal deposition. It was a Survivor Fund statement, and that is what he said at the time, and it is largely consistent with the evidence, right? And your critique of him saying that with the critique of the pole landing on the hood or in the windshield. Now, what we have, the reason I showed the Jason Ingersoll photos of the lamp post, it was just one of the pictures in front of the Pentagon that was pretty much a side view, was that you can see that there are three things that can be called poles. No one took the engineering description of what he meant by when he said a pole. There is the mast, and I've used the word mast to talk about the large pole that many people seem to say landed on his hood. There are also two other things that are long, very long, slender, things that in other circumstances people would call poles. I call them the upper lamp support arm and the lower lamp support arm to distinguish them, because otherwise we call them poles, that all three things would be poles, we'd be so confused I couldn't describe them. So I was very careful. Hopefully I didn't make any errors in the presentation talking about these three things called poles. The objection that the pole landed on his hood or in his windshield doesn't necessarily you can say that the plane hit a pole, the big mast, and another pole piece of the thing landed in my windshield. The word pole is still the appropriate word. They're just.
But we know that didn't happen, though, Wayne. We know that didn't happen because Lloyd said it didn't happen. He said it was the long part of the pole. Sorry to interrupt you, but
we're gonna hang in a second. So we can come back to that if you'd like. Now, the gradual curve is explainable, and I thought that the depictions that I came up with to describe the bends in slide 20 are mechanically correct. You know, not perfect, but they are mechanically correct. You know, I don't have great Photoshop capabilities here. This is the best I could do with PowerPoint and whatever it is I can work with. But that is a description of the plane hitting at midpoint, bending the pole, the lower part. The upper part is more severed. It separates at the upper reaches of the lamppost, and then the top parts fall down. The middle 5 foot section continues. So I think the curve is well explained by going and looking at those posts. Now, the curved scratch line on the pavement, of course, people have pointed that out. I don't see any great significance to it. If this is, in fact, such a highly staged event, the pole probably, you know, just making this up like everyone else does, maybe they would have dragged it from where it was standing into the lane instead of from way over the wherever it was back, you know. So the drag line is going in the wrong direction if you have to focus on that. Now, I said that the hole in the back seat is significant. Well, it's because it's a hole. You know, it's not a huge hole. It's not, you know, it is what it is. When Craig went with Lloyd and they reviewed this thing, that's what they commented. Oh, it's a hole. It's a small hole. It seemed to imply that How could a 20-foot pole, six inches in diameter thing made such a tiny hole? Well, how about if it was the lower arm of the lower lamp support arm of lamp post number two? I mean, that seems to be quite consistent with that. Now, I think you also had Lloyd actually saying that it was a lower, larger piece. I'm afraid that if you actually look at the CIT interviews in the places where he's pointing at the pole, he does not say that. He says, no, that's not it. And then there's all this blah, 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 and then move on to something else. Never in any of those CIT interviews does Craig ever say, well, how far was it sticking out? You never see any of that. All you see where he talks about the length of the pole is that in that living room scene, it's the only one I know of. It's the only one I've transcribed, paid enough attention to transcribe it. He has clearly never said that light pole was it. You have Craig saying, oh, that's the pole that hit you. And then he gets confused, doesn't know what he's going on, and that's when he turns and becomes very uncooperative. I mean, if you want to go through the text of what he says, I'll be glad to set aside another conversation here on the monthly conference call or someplace else. But if you actually listen to what they said in those interviews, he's not talking about that large piece. That's Craig saying, that's it, and Lloyd is either mumbling or saying, no, it's not. So do you have anything else you want to ask?
Well, I would just say that I don't want to take up more than my time here, but I think that he very directly says it's the long part of the pole. And I will, you know, before the next call, I will dig out an exact quote of that, and we can see if we want to discuss it again, you know, next time or whatever. But I believe he did very specifically say it was the long part of the pole. But,
well,
you know,
okay.
That,
well, maybe we'll have to wait until one of you finds some more positive quote from Lloyd that we can use for reference. Is that a thing, Craig?
Yeah,
okay,
fine.
So I think there are no more callers.